Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio and Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, supported in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. This is Ken in the reader's seat for today's August 21st, that's Friday, August 21st, reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And our first piece from Above the Fold: States COVID-19 data inconsistencies remain. Iowa officials first learned of flaws in their COVID-19 data system in July, but continued releasing erroneous data for weeks afterward, they confirmed Thursday. State leaders didn't publicly acknowledge the widespread errors or fix their system until Wednesday, 2 days after the Telegraph Herald and other media outlets reported on an email from a state official that disclosed the error. Meanwhile, in an extensive interview with the TH on Thursday, Iowa Public Health Director Caitlin Pirati shed light on multiple inconsistencies that continue to cloud local and statewide data even after the state purportedly fixed its reporting system. Timelines surrounding the discovery of data flaws came to light during Thursday press conference, during which Pirati confirmed that she first learned of the errors in late July. Moments earlier, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said she didn't become aware of the flaws until last week. Despite learning of these system errors, state officials did not publicly mention them and continued to post new figures to the state website and present flawed data as reliable indicators for how school districts should approach the start of a new year in which decisions on in-person instruction were tied to the flawed metrics. In the interview with the TH on Thursday, Pirati defended the continued rollout of this data. "We are trying to provide as much information as quickly as possible to help people understand what is going on," she said. "But there will be adjustments we have to make, and there are reviews that we do constantly to make sure that information is provided in an accurate and timely way." Iowa Senator Pam Yoakum, Democrat from Dubuque, said it was irresponsible to keep presenting erroneous data to the public, and despite recent system updates, she said she has continued to notice inconsistencies, as has the TH. "I am glad they finally admitted the issue," she said, "but it still doesn't seem like the data has been completely fixed." Mining the data. One such inconsistency can be found when looking at the number of positive cases, negative tests, and total tests. Cumulative numbers in Dubuque County as of Thursday afternoon showed 22,657 tests, but the combined number of positive and negative tests equaled only 22,490. State officials had not previously acknowledged or addressed such gaps in the data, and they continued to use the larger test total when calculating the county's to-date positivity rate. The phenomenon also affects specific days. State-reported figures from Tuesday, for instance, included 80 negative tests and 6 positive ones, yet reflected that a total of 88 tests were completed. The state used the 88 tests, not 86, to determine that day's positivity rate of 6.8%. Speaking to the TH, Pirati said the discrepancy is due to the presence of inconclusive tests. She also acknowledged that inconclusive tests are included in calculations of positivity rates. "They are still tests that are performed," Pirati said. "They are still a part of the total testing happening. They just didn't have a positive or negative result." Megan Sharivas, an infectious disease physician based in Fort Dodge, Iowa, said she was flabbergasted by the state's inclusion of inconclusive tests in positivity rates. She said this approach drives down positivity rates, despite the fact that no actual information was gleaned from the inconclusive tests. Inconclusive tests are exactly that, Srinivas said. They don't tell us if someone is positive or negative. It tells us nothing other than the fact that the person needs to be retested. Data inconsistencies also appear when analyzing week-long stretches of state reporting. During a recent 7-day stretch from August 13 to Wednesday, the overall number of confirmed positive cases in Dubuque County increased by 127. However, as of Thursday, the state website reflected just 91 of these cases on the individual daily totals in that 7-day stretch, a 28% decrease from the total number. Padotti said this vast difference is primarily the result of efforts to review and validate case information. She said the cumulative number shows the number of new cases in real time as they are reported to state officials. But she claimed many new cases are missing key information, such as the date, the individual's name or date of birth, and the test type. According to Padotti, new confirmed cases often are not added to a specific day or week until the necessary reviews are conducted by the IDPH. She acknowledged that this time lag results in fewer cases being calculated into the daily and 14-day positivity rates. Then tried to minimize the severity of such discrepancies by saying positivity rates are merely one of many useful metrics. There is not one single number we look at, Padotti said. It is not just the percent positivity or just the number of cases or the case rate. It is a lot of things together, and it needs to be. She also noted that positivity rates can reflect different things in different columns, or rather in different communities. When you look at percent positivity, it is important, but it needs to be understood in the context of the population and the testing resources and the people who are being tested, Padotti said. These statements fly in the face of state policy, which has singled out the 14-day positivity rate as the single key metric in whether schools can close their doors. State officials said late last month that school leaders only can ask for permission to close buildings or districts if their counties have a 14-day average positivity rate of at least 15%, and at least 10% of students are absent, or if the county has a 20% positivity rate over 14 days. A notice issued by the Iowa Department of Education last week softened that stance slightly, indicating that districts can apply for a move to temporary remote instruction without meeting these thresholds, and the application still will be considered. Padotti's revelations Thursday were the fifth different explanation offered by a state official since August 11 regarding inconsistencies between Iowa's COVID-19 data and the Telegraph Herald's calculations based on underlying figures supplied by the state. Efforts to fix data errors resulted in an immediate steep decline in the positivity rates of local counties. In Dubuque County, for instance, the 14-day rate now sits at just 7.2% after being nearly 3 percentage points higher just one day earlier. Calculations by the Telegraph Herald, based on the state's cumulative totals for numbers of new cases and new tests during the 14-day period, continue to yield higher averages. Over the 14-day period that ended 5 p.m. Wednesday, there were 238 new confirmed cases and 2,345 new tests in the county, equating to a positivity rate of 10.1%. Prior TH analyses also showed previous 14-day positivity rates that were consistently higher than provided by the state for Clayton, Delaware, Jackson, and Jones counties. And the discrepancies acknowledged by Padotti on Thursday are not necessarily specific to the TH coverage area. For example, as of Thursday night, the number of positive and negative tests statewide was more than 13,500 fewer than the total number of tests completed. But those 13,500 plus were being used when calculating the state's overall positivity of 9.3%. Such discrepancies provide an unsettling backdrop as local districts near the start of a new school year. Dubuque Community School Superintendent Stan Reingans said Thursday that he is confident in how his district is approaching the restart. From a system standpoint, I feel really good about what we have in place, he said. I am confident in our ability to wear masks and social distance. Inconsistencies in state data remain a concern, however. Reingans said he wants to learn more about the state's newest calculations before accepting their validity. All of us would be thrilled if the positivity rate was down in a way that made sense, he said. But we aren't celebrating yet. Until the math behind it can be explained in a way that makes sense, I will be a little skeptical. Reingans noted that district officials will be tracking the number of students and faculty members that test positive for COVID-19. This data will be reported on the district's website and break the information down to illustrate which building, and even which grade, the positive cases originated. Reingans feels such information will help students, families, and district officials make informed decisions. He emphasized that he won't hesitate to take swift action if this data indicates it is unsafe to attend classes in person. In such a scenario, he is prepared to close buildings even if that action skirts recommendations or lacks formal state approval. We won't wait for the county rate to reach that threshold, he said. We will make the decision that is best for our kids and our staff. If we have to go against the recommendation to keep people safe, that is what we will do. Our next front page piece is a bit of a shocker. Totally unexpected, at least by me. American Airlines halts service to Dubuque. American Airlines will halt air service to Dubuque Regional Airport for at least 1 month starting in October, citing low demand during the coronavirus pandemic. It didn't come as a surprise, but I was hoping we would never get to this point, said Dubuque Mayor Roy Buell on Thursday. Hopefully, it's just a month that we're looking at. American announced it will drop flights to Dubuque and 14 other smaller U.S. cities from its schedule covering October 7 to November 3. Spokeswoman Andrea Coos wrote in an email to the Telegraph Herald that the suspension includes all three daily flights to Dubuque. The airline blamed low demand during the coronavirus pandemic, which has triggered a massive slump in air travel and huge losses for the carriers. Airlines and their labor unions are seeking billions in new taxpayer relief. This is the first step as American continues to evaluate its network and plans for additional schedule changes in the coming weeks, the airline said in a prepared statement. Federal pandemic relief funding approved in March provided American with $10.7 billion in return for taxpayer dollars. Airlines were barred from furloughing workers and were required to continue serving destinations as they had before the pandemic. Both of those conditions expire September 30th. You look at the big picture, and all of the airlines are suffering, Buell said. They've been able to keep flights going thanks to the funding that they got from Washington. They have a lot of capacity, but low demand, and the airline industry is demand-driven. Dubuque Regional Airport Director Todd Dalsing said passenger travel has dropped 70% nationwide since 2019 because of COVID-19, an effect felt locally too. Our business and leisure demand has decreased, Dalsing said. July 2020, enplanements or passengers were down 67.7% in Dubuque compared to July 2019. That actually represented an improvement in year-over-year comparisons compared to April, down about 97%, May, about 92%, and June, about 80%. In April, American Airlines reduced its number of daily flights from Dubuque from 3 to 2. That dropped to 1 flight per day, 4 days per week in May, and 1 flight per day, 5 days per week in June. Dalsing said officials are actively engaging with American and our federal representatives to restore service to Dubuque and to maximize the number of daily flights. That is all going to be based on demand, he said. As demand increases, so will air service. Airlines have been lobbying for additional funding to avoid furloughs through next March. We're caught in a feud, said Rick Dickinson, executive director of Greater Dubuque Development Corporation. We're caught in the middle of negotiations between American Airlines and the U.S. Congress. Michael Zona, a spokesman for U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican, Iowa, noted in an email to the TH that airlines received significant taxpayer funds as a result of the CARES Act to retain jobs and services. Senator Grassley will work with the administration, his colleagues in Congress, and airlines to retain air service in Iowa, Zona wrote. The office of U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican, Iowa, echoed those sentiments. The office of U.S. Representative Abby Finkenauer, Democrat, Iowa, bemoaned the news. Abby has called on congressional leadership to extend protections under the CARES Act for aviation jobs as well as airline service to communities like Dubuque. And her office has followed up immediately with American Airlines about options and next steps for restoring service, her office said in a statement. This month-long cancellation of flights underscores the need for state and federal leaders from both parties to come together on additional coronavirus relief to speed our recovery. American said that without additional federal money, it could lay off or furlough 25,000 workers this fall. Coos wrote that she did not know what employment impact the suspension will have in Dubuque. We are still working through the impact these schedule suspensions will have on team members or contractors at the affected airports, she wrote. Molly Grover, president of Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce, expressed frustration at American's announcement. We're making sure our chamber members, our legislators, and American Airlines knows of our displeasure, she said. The Dubuque business community has had a long-standing relationship with American Airlines, and we've gone to bat for them time and time again. We're extremely frustrated. Dickinson said the benefactors of American Airlines' decision to suspend Dubuque service will be airports in Cedar Rapids and the Quad Cities, facilities that he said are already drawing potential passengers away from Dubuque's airport. There is about 75% leakage in our market for commercial travel already, he said. The immediate impact on the American Airlines decision will be on the remaining 25% that do travel out of Dubuque. This will mean a significant inconvenience for those travelers. Our final front page piece has a large picture of a red fire truck flanked by a number of other red fire vehicles and firefighters saluting as it passes. The caption reads, "Firefighters from Joe Davies County salute as an engine carrying the helmet of Scales Mound firefighter Benjamin R. Ben Weimer of Galena passes by the Galena Territory Station on Thursday. Weimer died unexpectedly earlier this month at his home, 1 year after his wife, Stacy, had passed. And our article, late firefighter honored. Fire engine slowly rode past the Galena Territory Fire Station on Thursday evening, flanked on both sides by saluting firefighters. Its lights flickered rapidly as the sun began to set over the hillside. It was silent all around, save for the rumble of the engine. This would be Ben Weimer's last call. Surrounded by his fellow firefighters, his ashes were carried past the station as his friends and family watched and grappled with a tragedy they couldn't comprehend. Last year, Ben's wife, Stacy Weimer, died without warning at her home. The tragedy struck the local fire department, but they rallied around Ben as he tried to raise his son as a single father. Last year, 1 year after the death of his wife, Ben died in an accident at his house. Tears filled the eyes of firefighters as they stood and watched the fire engine go by. The young couple had died suddenly and tragically, and their son now was left without his parents. I lost a very good friend, said Ken Calvert, local emergency medical technician and Ben's friend. It's just tragic what has happened to that family. It's just not fair. Ben and Stacy moved to the Galena area 4 years ago, hoping to escape the bustle of life in Chicago. After settling in the Galena Territory, it wasn't long before Ben joined the local fire department. Both of them were totally devoted to the fire department, said Doug Rodin, fellow firefighter and friend of Ben. They were always out there for helping. When Ben went out on calls, Stacy would do what she could to help the families of other firefighters or provide whatever other support that she could. The two were welcomed quickly and with open arms by the firefighters of the Galena Territory Fire Department. Even after Stacy's death, Ben continued to serve as a firefighter, all while trying to manage as a single father. Radin described Ben as kind and compassionate. He had experienced great tragedy, but still was the first one to be there for those who were experiencing heartbreak themselves. We lost our baby boy a few months after Stacy passed away, Radin said. I sent out a message to let friends and family know, and it wasn't 30 minutes before Ben had shown up at the hospital. He had tears in his eyes, and he just hugged all of us. During his time in Galena, Ben garnered the friendship and adoration of many of his fellow firefighters. His devotion to helping when needed only was matched by his cheerfulness. Whenever I saw him, he always had the biggest smile on his face, Calvert said. We were at a fire one time and he yelled at me from across the street to back up because a propane tank was going to blow. There wasn't any danger or anything like that, and he just had a big grin on his face. The news of Ben's death sent a wave of melancholy through the local fire department. They still were moving on from the loss of Stacy. Now, Ben was gone, too. I remember I was at work, and I had to leave the office, Radin said. It was happening again, and I just didn't have any words. A few days later, Weimer's family announced that they did not intend to hold a funeral due to safety concerns with the COVID-19 pandemic. Radin and other firefighters still wanted to do something for Ben. They organized a last ride, taking Ben's ashes from the fire station to the family's home in the Galena Territory. Fire and police departments from throughout Joe Davies County joined the procession. On Thursday, the long line of vehicles silently drove through the neighborhood of the Weimers' home. As the trucks passed by, neighbors stood out in their front yards, some holding flags and others with their hands on their hearts. As the vehicles pulled up to the Weimers' home, firefighters stepped out with Ben's ashes and his helmet in hand. As the fire engine continued to hum, they presented the helmet and ashes to his parents and son. Now we'll turn to our opinion page and the other review. Women's Voting Rights, Hard Won and Not Done, by Doris Kelly, Iowa's 19th Amendment Centennial Commemoration Committee. Prior to ratification of the 19th Amendment on August 18, 1920, and its formal certification on August 26, 1920, many small steps eventually led to suffrage, women's right to vote. It all started on June 12, 1840, when Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Lady Byron tried to attend the World Anti-Slavery Convention, though the invitation was only extended to gentlemen. The women were barred from attending and incensed that females were excluded from participating in any meeting. During that time period, American women were deprived of legal rights in virtually all dimensions of their lives. Excluded from college, wages belonged to husbands, couldn't own property, and custody of children went to spouse in dissolution of marriage. 8 years later, July 1848, Mott and Stanton held a public protest meeting in Seneca Falls, New York, noted in history books as the official start of the American women's suffrage movement. Between 1848 and 1920, 72 long years, mockery, ridicule, beatings, arrests, and imprisonment followed the suffragettes in their fight to earn the right to vote. Opposition, especially from virtually all male legislators in all states, was intense. Women's active role in the World War I industrial preparedness caused anti-suffragist President Woodrow Wilson to change his mind and announce in 1918 women's contribution during World War I had earned them the right to vote. The theme of Iowa's 19th Amendment Centennial Commemoration is Hard Won, Not Done. The hard-won element is in recognition of the 72-year, if not longer, fight to garner equal representation at the ballot box and in positions of leadership in government, business, and industry. Passage of the Equal Pay Act and Family and Medical Leave Act are other important milestones in advancing the position of women. But as witnessed by continual sexual harassment, spousal abuse, different legal rights for men and women, distinct societal expectations, women holding a minority of elected positions at city council, school board, county board, state legislature, and U.S. Congress, minority representation of female corporate board of directors, female minority as business CEOs, women earning about 80% of men's pay in similar positions, and America ranking 53rd on the Global Gender Gap Index, the not done portion of Iowa's 100-year commemoration is legitimate. As noted in the August 1st and 2nd, 2020 issue of the Wall Street Journal, the 19th Amendment was really just the start to extend, protect, and defend democracy. 100 years later, if not 172 years, women stand in the forefront to achieve greater diversity and equal rights. Several Iowans championed the suffrage movement. The most prominent was Charles City native Carrie Chapman Catt, 1859 to 1947, who created the Winning Plan in 1916 to gain support and eventual ratification of the 19th Amendment. Catt also founded the League of Women Voters in 1920, which continues to this day. 100 years later, a nonpartisan grassroots organization who believes in the power of their male and female members to help create a more perfect democracy. Cameo profiles of 22 Iowa women, 7 black and 15 white, who were instrumental in Iowa's suffrage movement can be found at https://19th-amendment-centennial.org under the heading Profiles of Courage and Persistence. The stories are a must-read to fully comprehend their dedication to Iowa being the fourth state to ratify the 19th Amendment, July 2nd, 1919. The narrative of the United States has been one of constantly seeking to perfect an imperfect democracy. Those who engage in the process of defending democracy, whether it was in 1848 or up to and including 2020, know firsthand the task is, in and of itself, hard won, not done. Doris Kelly is a former member of the Iowa House. She's chairwoman of Iowa's 19th Amendment Centennial Commemoration Committee, and her email is DKJKellyCFU.net. And now we continue with a few brief letters to the editor. Our first one, credit goes to TH, Dubuque City Council, from Betty Takes, Dunluth Court, Dubuque. We in Dubuque should be most proud of our TH news staff. I know that the TH is a credible, reliable, and accurate newspaper. It is evident by the accountability of the COVID-19 virus coverage. This discrepancy in the Iowa State numbers was caught by our TH staff. Kudos to you. Keep up the good work. I'm also proud of our city leaders for stepping up to the plate and making a decision on mandatory masks. It is imperative that masks be worn when out in public places if an end to this pandemic can be accomplished. Both of these actions take incredible courage to do. Thank you all. Our next letter. Community leaders need our support. From Father Russell Bleich, Mount Loretta Avenue, Dubuque. Hope is a big deal. It can be big deal do a little thing to support people who want to change things for the better for our brothers and sisters among us who struggle with poverty, injustice, or racism, who need help and hope. I want to stand with and speak up in support of the leaders of our community, the members of our Dubuque City Council, administration, staff, and others in dealing with complex, powerful structures and systems affecting the dignity and opportunity of our brothers and sisters. If you feel the same way, I invite you to say so to them and to your friends and neighbors. Hope is a big deal. Third piece, not in solidarity with new mural, from Joe Sabers, County Club Drive, Piasta. In agreement with Bert Goffinette's letter to the editor regarding the Five Flags mural, to some, a clenched fist may mean solidarity, but to others like me, a clenched fist portrays anger and harm. Unclench the fists and raise the hands in a stop position, meaning stop the violence, stop the hatred. I would hope that this change of the hand gesture would be a relatively easy solution. Continuing with our next piece, mural could send more peaceful message. From Janet Kreeb, First Street Southwest in Dyersville. Regarding the solidarity mural on the Five Flags building, I agree with previous letters that a joining of hands would send a much more peaceful message. The confrontational upward fists do not convey a comforting solution to any type of problem. And our final letter, looking forward in hopes of change. From Steve Hare, Lenox Street, Dubuque. I look forward to January 2021, when a new president can quote Gerald Ford from his August 9, 1974 inauguration. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. And we are just a bit past the midpoint of the reading of the Telegraph Herald, brought to you by IRIS, the Iowa Radio and Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap. This is Ken, and I am reading from the Friday, August 21st paper from the Telegraph Herald. Now, we will turn to today's obituaries. Susan J. DeMeo, Hazel Green. Susan J. Sue Sorensen DeMeo, age 62, of Hazel Green and formerly of Dubuque, passed away at 8:40 p.m. Monday, August 17th at UW Health University Hospitals in Madison. She had one last bittersweet moment surrounded with love by her partner in life, Roger Magby, and her siblings. To celebrate Sue's life, family and friends may visit from 1 until 5 p.m. Sunday, August 23rd at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main. Due to the COVID-19 mandate issued by the City of Dubuque, all who attend will be required to wear face masks. To honor Sue's life, funeral services will be held immediately following the visitation at 5 p.m. on Sunday at Bear Funeral Home, with Reverend Stephen M. Garner officiating. Burial will be in Belmont, Wisconsin, at a later date following cremation. Sue was the beloved second daughter of George and Mary Krogman Sorensen. She shared a birthday with her mother, which was May 23, 1958. Sue attended Nativity Catholic School and Senior High School. She married Mike DeMeo in May 1983, and after many years of marriage, they decided to go their own way. She then found her life partner, Roger Magby. Sue had many jobs over the years, starting with Fashion Touch dry cleaners. Later, she moved on to being a waitress at Nana's Breezy's and Burnt Toast. She also bartended at Bodine's and Knickers, and most recently worked as a cashier at Hy-Vee. Sue loved working with the public because, as everyone and anyone who knew her will say, Sue was a people person. She had an infectious smile and a laugh you'd never forget. She loved country music, going for Sunday rides in the boonies with Roger, playing cards with her sister and sisters-in-law, and was an avid Wheel of Fortune fan. Among her greatest treasures were her nieces and nephews and great-nieces and great-nephews. She loved every one of them as if they were her own. Sue was everyone's best friend, and she will be deeply missed. Memorials will be accepted by the family and may be mailed to Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main, Dubuque, Iowa, 52001. Attention, Susan DeMeo family. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com. Monty R. Dundee, Postville. Monty R. Dundee, 68, of Postville, died Monday, August 17th at his home. There will be a private graveside service. A celebration of life will be held from 2 to 6 p.m. Saturday, September 12th at Postville Fairgrounds. Schutte Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Postville is assisting the family. Joanne M. Lutis, Benton. Joanne May Lutis Shireman passed away peacefully and surrounded by loved ones at UW Hospital Madison, August 18th, at the age of 77 years. A celebration of life will be held at Lawrence's Pub and Eatery from noon to 3 p.m. Saturday, August 22nd. Casey McNett Funeral Home of Benton is assisting the family. Joanne was born on January 8, 1943, in Dubuque, Iowa, the daughter of George and Dolores Martin Shireman. She graduated from Benton High School in 1962. Joanne devoted her life to caring for children as an in-home daycare provider. When describing Joanne, selfless and kind are two words that come to mind. She was always thinking of others. It wasn't uncommon for her to have a pan of pumpkin bars and your favorite coffee and creamer ready for your visit, just because she knew it would make you happy. She opened her home to all and wanted to make sure you were comfortable when you came to visit. Joanne was married to Richard, the love of her life, and they were able to spend 60 wonderful years together, with 57 years united in marriage. They had three sons who would go on to have families of their own, granting her the opportunity to become a grandma and a truly wonderful one at that. She loved her grandkids and was a grandma-like figure to any kid that needed her. When she wasn't busy caring for others, Joanne enjoyed sitting on her porch swing with her husband, family luncheon outings, weekend trips to the casino, getting her nails done, and shoe shopping. Online condolences for the family may be left at www.caseymcnett.com. Janelle L. Bradshaw, Lancaster. Janelle L. Nellie Bradshaw, 75, of Lancaster, died on Wednesday, August 19th. A prayer service will be held at 7 p.m. Monday, August 24th, at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster. Visitation will be held from 3 p.m. to the time of the service Monday at the funeral home. Linda Becker, Galena. Linda Becker, 65, of Galena, died Wednesday, August 19th at home. There will be no public services. Cremation rites will be accorded. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Harlan Backhouse, Garnavillo. Harlan Backhouse, 90, of Garnavillo, died Tuesday, August 18th. There will be a private family service and internment. Tukey Allen Funeral Home of Garnavillo is assisting the family. Loris J. Wolfcool, Edgewood. Loris J. Wolfcool, 66, of Edgewood, died Wednesday, August 19th. Services are pending with Clifton Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Earlville. And finally, Harriet M. Freeze, Dickeyville. Harriet M. Freeze, 82, of Dickeyville, died on March 23rd. A mass will be held at 5 p.m. today, her birthday, at St. Andrew Church in Tennyson, with a celebration of life and meal to follow at Potosi Saloon. Casey McNett Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Cuba City is assisting the family. And, my dear listeners, I don't find any new arrivals today. We don't have anybody that has joined us, at least that's not in the paper. Now, a brief update from the Dubuque Tri-State area regarding our COVID cases. 18 new cases and one new death were reported in Dubuque County between 5 p.m. Wednesday and 5 p.m. Thursday, bringing the total of lives lost to 34. Dubuque County now has 1,862 positive cases. 8 people in the county with the coronavirus were hospitalized as of Wednesday. An additional 29 people previously diagnosed with COVID-19 were classified as recovered. With 18 new cases and 334 new tests reported in the county, the 24-hour positivity rate was 5.4%. The county's to-date rate was 8.2%. Over the 14-day period that ended at 5 p.m. Thursday, there were 243 new confirmed cases, 2,396 new tests, equating to a positivity rate of 10.1%. Statewide, 774 new cases were reported in the 24-hour period, pushing the total to 54,078. Our next piece, Steeple Square honors devout donor. And we have a group of people, some with masks, standing before a sign outside of the Steeple Square area. And the caption reads, siblings Jean McDonald, Rob McDonald, Trish McDonald, and Maria McDonald unveil a sign for the R.D. McDonald Steeple at Steeple Square in Dubuque on Thursday. The steeple is named after their father. On Sundays, when Trish McDonald was with her dad, her mornings were the same. She sat in awe, staring at intricate designs and red-painted ceilings embellished with gold inside St. Mary's Catholic Church. Each detail was memorizing, and she found herself easily lost in thought, admiring the magnificent church. I know I spent much of my time looking at the decorations and not listening, she said Thursday with a laugh. You could just sit here and look at all of the stuff all the way through Mass and never get bored. It was a church that her dad R.D. MacDonald, was devoted to, and because of him, she and her siblings, Jean MacDonald, Maria MacDonald, Sharon Young, and Rob MacDonald, also found themselves attached to its great halls and high ceilings. It became their church, too. On Thursday, the steeple structure, located at what was formerly St. Mary's, was renamed the R.D. MacDonald Steeple in honor of the MacDonald family after their donation to help complete a $2.3 million renovation of the steeple. The MacDonald family, along with grants, tax credits, and other donations, helped fund the revitalization of the steeple, said Nicole Gantz of the Steeple Square Board of Directors. In 2010, St. Mary's was deconsecrated, and rather than tear down the more than 150-year-old building, local families and businesses partnered together and turned St. Mary's into what it is today, a nonprofit organization offering an event venue, childcare services, apartments, and more. We just continue to look for opportunities to see what best fits the space we have and the needs of the community, and in particular, this downtown area, to help a lot of people launch successful careers, said Judy Wolf, Steeple Square Board Treasurer. Trish McDonald said the city's downtown would have had a void without Steeple Square. The building is a huge part of the city's identity, and to watch it torn down would have been devastating, she said. I think, for me and my siblings, going to church with Dad was an adventure, she said. We felt connected there. It was an important part of our lives, and we know how important it was to the community. All of us kids are so proud. This is a lasting tribute to my dad and all the residents in Dubuque. John Schmidt, president of Steeple Square and A.Y. MacDonald's chief financial officer, said Steeple Square has been impacted by many generous donors, but Thursday night was a night to recognize the MacDonald family for everything they have done to maintain and improve the historic building. I think, from our perspective, it is an identification of the commitment of the family that's been made not just to Steeple Square, but the community, he said. We've had a lot of donors. The number of donors that have impacted this is tremendous. In this case, we are looking at the steeple, and it is just a chance to celebrate R.D. MacDonald. And now we continue with some pieces of news in brief from around our area. Police: man arrested after punching another motorist in Dubuque road rage incident. Police said a man faces charges following a road rage incident in Dubuque. David R. Shutkin, 56, was arrested at 6:50 a.m. Thursday in the 1800 block of Admiral Sheehy Drive on a warrant charging first-degree burglary and false reports to law enforcement. Court documents state that Shutkin was involved in a road rage incident at about 3 p.m. August 11th. On the off-ramp to Kerper Boulevard from U.S. 61-151. Traffic camera footage shows Shetkin's vehicle following a northbound vehicle driven by Antonio Moreno Sayago, 24, of Hazel Green, when both take the ramp and stop at the red light at the intersection with Kerper. The documents state that the footage shows Shetkin exiting his vehicle and approaching Moreno Sayago, who is inside his vehicle. Shutkin opens the driver's door, grabs Moreno Sayago, and punches him in the face. Moreno Sayago exits his vehicle and tries to speak with Shutkin, who again punches him in the face. Platteville academic bus routes altered due to COVID-19. Platteville Public Transportation has altered academic bus routes this fall due to COVID-19. Effective Saturday, August 22nd, a 10-rider maximum capacity will be enforced and riders will be required to wear face coverings. Orange, blue, and red routes will operate from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday. The purple route will operate from 7 to 11:30 p.m. Friday and from 2 to 11:30 p.m. Saturday. The green route will operate from 7 p.m. to 3:30 a.m. Friday and Saturday. There is no Sunday service. patrons with disabilities requiring accessible transportation should call 608-348-6767 to schedule being picked up. Dubuque Church to hold free food distribution Saturday. Westminster Presbyterian Church will hold a free food distribution from 9 a.m. until food supplies are exhausted Saturday, August 22nd. The event will be held at the church at 2155 University Avenue. The distribution is held in partnership with the St. Stephen's Food Bank, a branch of Riverbend Food Bank, according to a press release. Recipients do not need to register in advance. Participants should remain in their vehicles during the drive-through distribution. And we'll finish with a few of our weekend buzz pieces, the noteworthy things to do this weekend in the tri-states. And even amidst the COVID virus, we do have a couple of nice musical events going on. We have Summer's Last Blast today, the Dubuque County Fairgrounds, 6 p.m., free live music from Tanner Lee and the Beach Bums, Menace and Electric Shock. Fireworks will take place at 9:30. And one other piece, we have the rooftop concert planned for Saturday. Dubuque, Main Street, and the Smokestack will host another free rooftop concert featuring local musicians. The concert will take place at 6 p.m. Saturday, August 22nd, at the Dubuque County parking lot, 705 White Street. Food and beverages will be available for purchase from Charlotte's Coffee House, Hot Diggity Dogs, and Food Store. The event also will include a free education station that will hand out masks and provide public health information. Those attending are required to wear masks when unable to remain 6 feet apart, as well as follow other guidance provided by the City of Dubuque and other state and federal officials. For more information, visit Dubuque Main Street and Smokestack's Facebook pages, as well as downtowndubuque.org/event/rooftop-concert. And, my dear listeners, that brings us to the end of the reading of today's Friday, August 31st edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. It has been a joy to be with you and to have you listen through IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, which is so wonderfully, in part, subsidized by DUPACO and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. So until next week, be safe. Enjoy the fresh air outside. It's going to be nice this weekend. Take a little walk. Take some nice deep breaths and enjoy things. But be safe. See you next week. Well, I won't see you, but you'll hear me. Listen in next week. So long.
This is Jim Ralston with an IRIS short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. A one-horse, two-tractor town. Clermont. This small town, population 716, is blessed with not one, but two famous, at least by Iowa standards, tractors. Both set conveniently on Main Street, about one block apart, in small, simple wooden buildings with large plate glass windows facing the street for easy viewing. There's no admission charge, no lines, and the night we visited, not a single other adult downtown. Just three kids playing tag in the middle of the quiet street. The first and perhaps most famous tractor is the green 1966 John Deere riding lawnmower, an absurdly large attached trailer, complete with small set of antlers up front, featured in the 1999 David Lynch film, The Straight Story. The real, original straight tractor is in Lawrence. See, A Lawnmower Ride with Friends in Chapter 5. Based on a true story, the film chronicles the adventures of Alvin Straight, a 73-year-old retiree from Lawrence, Iowa, who, having lost his driver's license because of poor eyesight, decides to drive his lawnmower more than 240 miles across two states to visit his estranged and ailing brother in Mount Zion, Wisconsin. Along the way, he meets a pregnant runaway, a fellow World War II vet, and a priest, among others, and there's plenty of heartwarming straight talk between Alvin and his fellow Iowans. When someone asks why he's driving a tractor at top speed of 5 miles per hour all the way to Wisconsin, he says simply, "My eyes are bad. I can't drive. I don't have someone else driving. And I've got to get out to my brother." Spoken like a true Iowan. The second tractor, though, less famous, is still impressive. It's a 1927 Hart Parr manufactured in Charles City, Iowa. The rusty machine sits atop a faded purple shag carpet, a keepsake from the tractor's 1970s disco phase, looking exactly like what it is, a very old tractor. The manufacturer of the machine, Hart Parr, is famous for having coined the term tractor when the company shortened the old name for machines, gasoline tractor engines. The information posted besides the tractor kindly explain that it has two-cylinder, four-cycle, horizontal valve in-head engine. If you know what that means, you're either a farmer or a good candidate for a very old tractor repair school. The tractors are located on Main Street, US 18, in downtown Clermont. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities. Quirky characters, odd roadside oddities, and other offbeat stuff. By Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.